Good morning. Flights are getting delayed as officials say more air traffic controllers are calling in sick while required to work without pay during the shutdown. We'll speak with their union's president. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. After Charlie Kirk's assassination, how has the state of free speech in America changed? I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We hear from streamer Hassan Piker, who describes himself as Kirk's counterpart on the left. And the author of a new biography of James Baldwin on why he calls it a love story, how Baldwin's relationships with friends and lovers shaped the views of the 60s icon. It is Wednesday, October 8th. On this day in 1956, New York Yankee Don Larsen pitched the only perfect game in World Series history, helping to beat the Brooklyn Dodgers. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. This year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry has been awarded to three scientists. They are Susumu Kitagawa, Richard Robson, and Omar Yagi for the development of metal organic frameworks. Their studies could lead to the creation of new materials with new properties. This is day 8 of the federal government shutdown. It's affecting air travel. NPR's Giles Snyder says there are staffing shortages among air traffic controllers.
The list of airports reporting staffing shortages is widening. The FAA adding Houston and Dallas to the list that includes Boston, Chicago, and Philadelphia, as well as control centers in Atlanta and the Dallas-Fort Worth area. In Nashville, the FAA implemented a ground stop Tuesday evening due to insufficient staff. According to the flight tracking website FlightAware, there were more than 3,000 delays on Tuesday.
NPR's Giles Snyder reporting. Meanwhile, President Trump is suggesting that some furloughed federal workers may not get any back pay after the shutdown is over. Former FBI Director James Comey will appear in a federal courthouse today to formally hear two felony charges against him. Comey is a critic of President Trump, and his arraignment comes a day after U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi sparred with Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee. NPR's Elena Moore reports they say she has used her agency to go after Trump's political enemies.
Committee Democrats used their time to press Pam Bondi on a slew of recent moves that they say are politically motivated, including the indictment of former FBI Director James Comey and the decision to close a federal probe into border czar Tom Homan, who allegedly accepted a $50,000 bribe from an undercover FBI agent. Many exchanges grew heated, including this one with California Democrat Adam Schiff.
You can attack me after my time is over.
You've attacked all of us, including President Trump, for your entire career.
You can attack me later, and I know you've got plenty of canned attacks. We've heard them all day today.
Senate Republicans praised Bondi's work, saying she's repaired an agency that had previously been weaponized against President Trump. Elena Moore, NPR News.
Texas National Guard troops have arrived in Illinois after President Trump ordered them to go there. The Texas newsroom's Blaze Ganey reports the Texas National Guard troops were deployed against the wishes of Illinois officials.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker condemned the move as an invasion and urged Texas Governor Greg Abbott to withdraw support. But Abbott has backed Trump's decision and posted photos of Texas Guard members boarding planes, calling them elite and ever ready. Normally, governors control their National Guard units, but the president can federalize them in rare situations, a power the Trump administration argues is justified by what they call rebellion against federal authority. The administration says the troops are needed to protect federal personnel and property as immigration enforcement intensifies. I'm Blaze Ganey in Austin.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. High-level talks opened today in Egypt to try to end the war in Gaza. President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will be there. So will his envoy, Steve Witkoff. Qatar's prime minister will also join. Hamas negotiators are saying they're seeking guarantees from the U.S. that if they release hostages, Israel will put a final end to the war. The Associated Press is projecting winners in a Tennessee special congressional election. The candidates are seeking to replace Republican Congressman Mark Green. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Mariana Bacayao has more.
Green retired from Congress just 6 months into his term. President Donald Trump's pick to replace him, Matt Van Epps, has sailed through a crowded Republican primary. Trump endorsed the former state commissioner just days before the election, and out-of-state groups poured money into defeating his anti-school voucher opponent, State Representative Jody Barrett. Van Epps will face Democratic state lawmaker Afton Bain in the general. Since redistricting in 2022 incorporated parts of Nashville into the mostly rural district, Democrats are hopeful that the reliably Republican seat can be flipped blue. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Baca-Yao in Nashville.
Chinese media say all climbers on Mount Everest who were trapped by a heavy and sudden snowstorm have been rescued. The Associated Press says about 900 hikers, guides, and staff had been stranded. Hundreds were able to descend the mountain. Earlier, some witnesses had said the snowfall on Everest was so heavy that it collapsed tents. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Betty Klein always desired to be a mother. And over the years, she was happy to bring five boys into the world. November 10th, 1951. Betty's three youngest boys asked if they could play in Farview Park. She obliged and reminded them to be home before supper. But hours passed. Betty sent her eldest to find them. They weren't at the park or anywhere. The search began. Police officers and Boy Scouts went door to door. After day three, the phone rang. Police reported that the boys' red hats were found by the Mississippi River. Had they drowned? After 5 days, the case was closed, but the tips kept coming in. A young woman claimed she saw three kids on the curbside crying. Some suspected the neighborhood park groundskeeper, who previously been investigated for murder. Besides, the children's bodies weren't found in the river. Betty and her family never accepted the drowning theory. The three boys were never found, and their disappearance remains a mystery to this day.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The price of gold is now higher than ever, which is great for anyone who has it, but it's also a potential warning about what's going on with the economy overall. We'll have that story in a few minutes. But first, though,
it's been a tough week for the air traffic control system in the United States.
Because at 103, stand by. We're going to be closing the tower soon, and SoCal's going to be taking control of the airport. So for now, stand by.
That's an air traffic controller at the Hollywood Burbank Airport on Monday, explaining to pilots that the local tower was about to close because of a staffing shortage.
Ground's closed, local's closed, the tower is closed due to staffing. So you just contact SoCal on the 800 number in the green book for your clearance. All right.
Some of those pilots sound surprised, as you can hear in this archived audio recording from the website liveatc.net.
Is it because of the shutdown that you guys are going to? It's for stopping.
That led to major delays at just that one airport on Monday, and the government shutdown is only making commercial aviation issues even worse. NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose has been following what's happening in the skies and also on the ground. Joel, what kind of delays are you seeing?
Yeah, the Federal Aviation Administration says that staffing shortages caused delays at several airports again yesterday, including a full ground stop for a while at the airport in Nashville. Also, we saw delays at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago and Dallas Love Field. And we are looking at the possibility of more delay today. You know, I should note the FAA will limit the number of planes in the air in order to keep the system safe. But that said, it is probably not a great week for getting where you need to go on time.
And how is this? I mean, can this squarely be laid on the feet of the government shutdown, or are there deeper problems?
Yeah, there was already a nationwide shortage of air traffic controllers, which has nothing to do with this government shutdown. Staffing is several thousand controllers short of where the FAA and the controllers union say it should be. Nearly 11,000 certified controllers do have to work during the shutdown, but they do not get paid until it ends. And during the last one of these in 2019, we saw controllers calling in sick in higher than normal numbers, especially once that stoppage dragged on past a month. And that caused serious delays at airports on the East Coast and may have played a key role in bringing that shutdown to an end. There has been an uptick in the number of controllers calling in sick this week, according to federal officials. And it does not take huge numbers to have a big impact on a system that is already so short-staffed.
Yeah. What about rural airports? Tell us what's happening there.
Yeah. There is a federal program that subsidizes flights to rural airports. It's called the Essential Air Service Program. The Trump administration says that program will run out of money as soon as this weekend if the shutdown continues. And that could be a big deal for the almost 170 communities around the country that are part of this program, including more than 60 in Alaska alone. I talked to Daniel Friedenzone about this. He's a professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Florida.
It provides airline service to communities that probably would not have it. So it is important from the community's perspective, and I think that's partly why the Congress generally has been so supportive of it.
But all that said, it is not clear exactly how much of an immediate impact this funding lapse could have. At least one major carrier, Alaska Airlines, says it will continue flights for now, even without this subsidy. And it is likely that the smaller regional airlines that operate most of these flights would do the same, at least in the short run. You know, and one other thing I want to note, the White House proposed cutting more than $300 million in funding from this program earlier this year, even though the program does have broad bipartisan support in Congress.
That's NPR's Joel Rose. Joel, thanks.
Thank you.
Let's hear from the person who represents air traffic controllers as a group, the president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. He was nice enough to come by our studios. Nick Daniels, good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
So the transportation secretary blamed delays at airports on, quote, a slight tick up in sick calls, unquote, by air traffic control workers. Does that sound right to you?
The number of air traffic controllers as it was already reported, is extremely low to begin with. As far as flight delays being blamed on it, flight delays happen every single day for a ton of reasons that we are the ones left to contend with. There's only 10,800 of us when there should be 14,633. Only one or two sick calls on any given day puts us in a position to where we have to either restrict traffic, combine sectors and positions, and ultimately we have procedures to deal with this.
So how many are calling in sick? Is it one or two a day?
Yeah, it depends on the level of facility. We have some facilities that have 300 people inside of them. We have some facilities that have 10. Because we operate 313 different facilities.
Is it organized?
No, it's not organized in any way, shape, or form. I represent a proud group of professionals that show up to do their job each and every day. Anybody that went out and did something nefarious would be acting on their own, but not because of this union.
To the point, though, air traffic controllers are deemed essential, which means they are expected to work without pay, even during a shutdown. Briefly, just describe the conditions they're working under.
What they're working under is one of the lowest morale times in history. They're going to work. They know they're short-staffed already. The pressure that's on top of them, they work with unreliable equipment. And all of those things add up to the stress and complexity of one of the most high-consequence jobs in the entire world.
So, like, earlier this week, right, the Hollywood Burbank Airport near Los Angeles operated with no air traffic controllers. Their counterparts in San Diego were managing air traffic. There were delays of, like, 2.5 hours, according to the FAA. You've done this job. Like, so how do air traffic controllers keep people safe under those conditions?
They've done it for 25 years, and our safety is number one. And we've seen this. That was not the first time Burbank has ever closed down. That was not the first time that an airport has had to close due to staffing. There's been 1,000 occurrences this year alone that we've had an air traffic control, what we call zero, at a facility for either equipment or for staffing. So when we have somebody else take over that airspace, controllers just can't operate at the same level of efficiency.
1,000 incidences of air traffic control towers having to close down so far this year alone?
Some parts of a facility. We have tower and tracons or different areas inside of an in-route facility. And yes, over 1,000 occurrences where we've dealt with this very thing. It's just now front page news. Uh-huh. And we're glad it's front page news so people can see the state of the system and why we're advocating so hard to fix it.
Well, speaking to that, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy talks about modernizing air traffic control. We've heard about archaic technology in the control tower, talking about floppy disks, if people even remember what that is, you know, paper. What happens to efforts to modernize when the government shuts down?
The sad part is, and the reality is, we had to stop many of the different projects or even sustaining the system as it is leading up to the shutdown, because you have to start canceling all the travel, all the plans, all the meetings, and the air traffic controllers are focused on their on the job of ensuring that we get through the shutdown, and in no way able to work on the projects that are coming up ahead. So every day that this lasts is just another day it's going to add on to the problem existing later. Secretary Duffy has found ways to ensure that the training continues and some of these projects go on, but they're not at full force and full speed.
As we just heard from our reporter Joel Rose, during the 2019 shutdown, air traffic controllers called out sick, which caused disruptions at airports on the East Coast. I mean, obviously, I can, just from our conversation, I'm sure there's some dispute about just how much of a factor that was in the delay. But that pressure is believed to have helped end the shutdown. Do you think the same thing could happen here again?
The message that I've wanted to make extremely clear is air traffic controllers don't start a shutdown. Air traffic controllers don't end a shutdown. Politicians are the only ones that start a shutdown and have the ability to end it. Air traffic controllers are going to show up and do everything we can. But the longer that this lasts, it's going to place a continued strain on air traffic controllers, the stress, the pressure. Air traffic controllers have to show up to save people's lives. And if they're not fit for that duty because they're worried about, you know, everything that's going on at home, putting food on the table, gas in the car, making sure their kids are looked after, that's something that we have to face, and it's something that's going to be real every single day that this continues, and they start seeing $0 paychecks on October 28th.
That is Nick Daniels. He's president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, and I also want to mention a Marine veteran. Thank you so much for your service, and thanks for coming in this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, and thank you to every American who is out there supporting the air traffic controllers during this difficult time.
Thanks so much.
Gold was already having a good year, and it just broke another record. This week, the price of gold went above $4,000 an ounce for the first time ever. NPR finance correspondent Maria Aspen explains why that is not a good sign for the economy.
Gold is one of the oldest investments around, especially in times of turmoil. It's shiny and solid and widely seen as a safe haven when investors are worried about what else is going on in the world, and especially in the United States.
Gold usually rises if the dollar is weak.
That's Jose Rasco, Chief Investment Officer for HSBC in the Americas. As he points out, the dollar is weak. It's down about 10% this year. That's in part because of all the uncertainty created by President Trump, from his tariffs to how he's picking fights with the Federal Reserve. Investors around the world are worried about the long-term damage these policies could have on the broader economy. These worries aren't obvious. Stock markets have been hitting record high after record high. But dig a little deeper, and it's clear that investors are trying to hedge their bets and diversify away from the United States.
Given all the uncertainty around policy, people said, we're not sure about the dollar, and the dollar has depreciated as a result.
Now, the price of gold is already up about 50% this year, its best run in nearly half a century. And Goldman Sachs this week predicted that it will go up even more by the end of next year. Don Stroyven is Goldman's co-head of commodities research. He points out there's another factor here. The Fed is cutting interest rates.
When interest rates go down, demand for gold from investors tends to rise.
That's partly because lower rates can lead to higher inflation, and gold is a hedge against inflation. It can also just feel like a security blanket for nervous investors. After all, the last time gold was this hot was back in 1979, in the middle of a global energy and inflation crisis that made the world seem very uncertain. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
And that's as good as gold.
I'd love to rush into the...
This is NPR News.
KEXE was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town, and it magically became a, there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KEXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We're in crisis mode. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
Turn your radio on.
Comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A hefty new biography of James Baldwin is asking us to read the celebrated writer and civil rights leader through a new lens. Baldwin, A Love Story by Nicholas Boggs, centers Baldwin's male lovers, along with his family and many friends, in order to better understand him and his works. To learn about the book, we took a trip to Harlem, New York, where Baldwin was born, with author and scholar Nicholas Boggs.
Here we are at James Baldwin Place at 128th Street and Fifth Avenue. He and his family moved around a lot in this area.
Yeah, like a lot of people without money.
Yeah,
you exactly. Get kicked out of places. You have to move. Plus, they had a lot of kids in that house. He was what? The oldest of what?
The oldest of nine.
Nine.
Yeah, yes. So. And I believe this is his school, PS24, down here, where he met Bill Miller. And she's the one who took him to see plays and movies and really changed his life. And
they How old was he when he was in her class?
10.
He was 10 years old.
And he was reading A Tale of Two Cities, and so was she. And she was blown away by his intelligence, and but she also recognized that he wasn't being challenged in school because this was an overbooked school, too many students, so she took upon herself to take him out, and eventually she became part of the family even. She was
just a few blocks from Baldwin's elementary school sits another cornerstone of his education, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, which was expanded from the Harlem branch of the New York Public Library.
Well, he may have been exaggerating a little bit, but he said that by the time he was like 15, he had read everything in the library. And so it was a sanctuary for him, and it was life-changing.
The Schomburg is now home to the James Baldwin Papers, a vast archive documenting Baldwin's career. Nicholas Boggs and I sat down for our conversation there. For people who aren't as familiar with James Baldwin as others might be, just situate him for us. Why was he such a towering figure?
James Baldwin's face was on the cover of Time magazine in 1963. Okay, and this is sort of the height of the civil rights movement. So he, if for no other reason, he's important because he is a titan of that movement. He was the voice of Black America. He was appearing on television all the time.
Here's James Baldwin on the Dick Cavett Show in 1969.
The word Negro in this country is designed finally to disguise the fact that when it's talking about another man, a man like you, who wants what you want. And insofar as the American Republic wants to think there has been progress, they overlook one very simple thing. I don't want to be given anything by you. I just want you to leave me alone so I can do it myself.
He was what we'd call a public intellectual. I don't even know if we used that term back then, but he was what we'd call a public intellectual.
He was an absolute celebrity. I mean, he was best friends with people like Marlon Brando, Maya Angelou, Nina Simone, Lena Horne, Harry Belafonte, you name it. I mean, he, when it came to Black America, there'd never been anything quite like that in this country.
What was his message?
Well, his message was a message about love, and that is part of why that's the focus of this book. His message was that, as he put it in The Fire Next Time, Only love will throw open the gates to liberation. And he thought that blacks and whites had to come together like lovers, as he put it, and really excavate the past and the present, come to a kind of mutual recognition and understanding by really confronting the past, not erasing, not pretending that slavery and its legacies were somehow gone. And he had the concept that he used was innocent. He said white Americans have to not pretend that they are innocent. The innocence constitutes the crime.
He's known for his incisive, hard-hitting commentaries about race. But one of the points that you make in the book is that he talked about how race as a form of oppression doesn't live alone. It's connected to all these other forms of oppression around sexuality, around gender. And, you know, we have words for that now. We call it intersectionality, but I don't think that too many other intellectuals were thinking in those terms or talking in those terms at that time. I mean, how was that received?
Well, his essays early in his career and for most of his career were really about, you know, race relations, right? However, his insights into sexuality were key. He felt menaced by his sexuality, right, by these categories. So he really had to think about it. And he had to think about the way that miscegenation, right, at the heart of enslavement in this country, was a sexualized dynamic. But he said, when he asked why he wrote Giovanni's Room, and he said, if I hadn't written this novel, I don't know if I could have ever written again. This was something in himself that he had to confront, right, his own sexuality. And he said, no one could blackmail him then. You didn't tell me, I told you. That's what he said. So this is how he kind of rejected these systems of domination in terms of these identities.
We look at his body of work now and we think, oh my gosh, he was so productive. But he had many periods where he was really struggling. He was struggling to get published. He was struggling to get his career off the ground. He had many projects that never saw fruition. Do you think that those are all related? How do you understand that?
Well, listen, I think Baldwin was a human being. And that's one of the things that I really tried to sort of explore and get across in this book. And in some ways, yes, he had some difficult relationships, shall we say. But what struck me as I wrote the book was actually how incredible it was that he had these relationships that sustained him for so long and came in and out. So Baldwin loved his family here in Harlem, but he was living most of his life abroad, so he had to construct these alternative kinship structures, right? So Buford Delaney was his spiritual father. Then Lucien Hapersberger, his first great love in Paris. They were together on and off for years. Yeah, they had some really rocky times, but it was Lucien who came to his bedside and was there when he died. I mean, they became like family. The same with Engin Cezar, who I also explore, his Turkish friend. Yaron Kazak as well. So while he had these frustrations, he also provides a model for like a kind of expansive, sort of erotic and platonic life with other people that can move in and out of these different iterations. However, there is no denying that difficulties of racism and homophobia had a very, very negative impact on him.
What would you say is Baldwin's legacy?
It is a legacy of love. It's a difficult love. It's a risky love. It's not like this easy romantic love. He always said that love is a battle. Love is a war. Love is a growing up. And that's because his journey to self-love was difficult, right? But the journey that we're on now in America to reclaim our humanity is also going to be a battle and a war. And I don't mean that in terms of weapons. I mean that internally, inside of us as Americans, coming to really trying to truly see each other as human beings.
Nicholas Boggs, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's great to be here, Michelle.
Nicholas Boggs is the author of Baldwin, A Love Story. This is NPR News.
In Italy, a supervolcano outside of Naples is stirring in a way it hasn't for centuries. Hundreds of thousands of people live in the crater left by its past eruptions.
One thing that you learn very soon is that we do not have the control. Nature has the control.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We hear from the scientists studying the volcano at its crater on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday morning show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Thanks to our listeners, you have helped us raise over $170,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KXC is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate or share our work. Visit kaxe.org. It's National Fire Prevention Week now through October 11th, and the Minnesota DNR offers guidelines for wildfire prevention. Keep campfires small and manageable, and always have plenty of water nearby. Hold off on burning large debris piles until there is 3 inches of snow cover. Always check if a burning permit is needed at mndnr.gov/burning permit. If you see a wildfire, move to a safe location and call 911. The Arrowhead Library System presents They Brought Their Songs, International Folk Music in Minnesota, with musical trio Kaylee, now through November 5th. Find a full list of dates, times, and locations at als.info. Fire in the Village hosts the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. The Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork hosts an opening reception from 5 to 7 on Thursday, October 9th for a new exhibit of paintings and murals called Anima Mundi. Meet the artist, and you can stay for the classic movie series at 6:30. This month's film is Night of the Living Dead from 1968. Pine River Market Square will hold an indoor growers and crafters market Saturday, October 11th from 10 to 2 at the Warehouse on Norway Avenue in Pine River. Local band Every Bird will provide live music. Now for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, October 8th, 2017, Jan from Warba, Minnesota, reports seeing a last ruby-throated hummingbird. This is quite late in the season, and when I look back in my records, the average date for the last hummingbird to be seen in northern Minnesota is the 19th of September. The earliest was in 1984 and 2006 when I recorded my last hummingbird on the 4th of September. And in 2008, there was a hummingbird sighted on the 18th of October, in 2010 on the 3rd of October, and then, of course, this note, which was on the 8th of October in 2017. These migrators are probably just the last ones to get the message that it's time to head south. So I guess the lesson to be taken here is if you have a small hummingbird feeder, it might be wise to leave it up into October a little bit. You never know whose life you might be saving.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. When President Trump returned to office, he touted one executive order in particular.
And I have stopped all government censorship and brought back free speech in America. It's back.
That commitment was tested almost immediately when international college students involved in Palestinian activism started getting detained and threatened with deportation.
Armed agents of the state who kidnapped her from outside of her home.
Disappearing people off of American streets.
The fact that you can kidnap someone basically from their home for going to a protest is terrifying.
At the time, free speech advocates warned immigration enforcement was being used as a tool for censorship.
Your citizenship won't save you. Your views will be next.
So we here at Morning Edition examined the state of the First Amendment at the time. Who felt more free to speak? Who felt silenced? And the way this right, from which all other rights flow, is shifting in America. It's a question that's come up again and again, most recently after the killing of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. The administration is making it clear that some speech will have consequences. So we're resuming conversations on the First Amendment in the weeks ahead, starting with Hassan Piker, who's described himself as Kirk's counterpart on the ideologically opposite side. Piker is the most popular leftist streamer in North America on Twitch, where he streams nearly 8 hours a day to an audience of millions. And he was live streaming when he saw the video of Kirk's assassination.
Holy America is so absolutely.
He was shocked by the murder of a public figure like him. But what happened in the weeks after scared him in a new way. The vice president encouraged people to call the employers of anyone celebrating Charlie Kirk's death. Dozens of teachers, professors, journalists were fired over personal social media posts or commentary. President Trump signed an executive order designating Antifa not a group but an ideology, a domestic terrorist organization. The federal communications chair, Brendan Carr, made a not-so-subtle threat against ABC over a comment Jimmy Kimmel made. ABC pulled him off the air. It got fierce backlash across the ideological spectrum. From Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
I think it is unbelievably dangerous for government to put itself in the position of saying, we're going to decide what speech we like and what we don't.
To right-wing podcaster Candace Owens.
Do you understand? We never, ever, ever should be applauding federal action when it comes to speech.
Kimmel is back on the air, but questions around free speech are louder than ever. And Hassan Piker thinks Americans should have been alarmed a long time ago when the first student protester was detained by immigration agents.
I kept warning people saying, look, it's not going to stop. They're using the immigration enforcement agenda as a vehicle.
He's a fierce critic of U.S. foreign policy, of Israel's war in Gaza, of Trump, and conservatives paint him as a radical extremist. During Kirk's memorial, Piker listened to Trump say he would go after influencers, to Trump's top advisor, Stephen Miller, threaten an undefined they.
They cannot imagine what they have awakened. They cannot conceive of the army that they have arisen in all of us.
So when we spoke, I asked what he sees taking shape.
I think that they're trying to mobilize against all kinds of political dissidents. They want to stamp it out. That much is clear to me. The anti-fascism terrorism designation is both illegal and also intentionally vague to such a degree that if you actually organize any sort of protest against ICE or you demand identification from ICE agents, which is something within the confines of reasonability and totally legal to do, right? Then you could be considered a domestic terrorist, a designation that hasn't existed. We're talking about a country where, objectively, the overwhelming majority of political violence, whether it be mass shootings or school shootings alike, are happening by right-wingers, like far-right anti-government extremists. This is the ADL's own data. This is the Department of Justice's own data that has shown this reality.
Right, data that has now disappeared from their website.
Yes, something that they deleted. But even from the perspective of, like, political violence, it's very obvious that the administration has decided that we live in a post-truth era and that they can simply say this was a leftist Antifa shooter anytime there is any shooting. One of the most damaging aspects of this misinformation, I think, has been that people believe it. People now think that leftist violence is happening with regular frequency. And I think that this is presented in an environment where the administration is trying to, one, create this hysterical narrative, and then, two, stamp out this kind of leftist violence that they have cultivated in their minds. It's a truly terrifying media environment, but it's a suppression that I'm familiar with, obviously.
Familiar because he was detained and questioned by Customs and Border Protection on his way back into the country in May. What were they asking you?
They asked me how I feel about Donald Trump. They asked me about my opinions on Israel. They asked me my opinions on Hamas. But one of the most interesting questions that I got in that process was if I had actually interviewed anyone from a known State Department designated terrorist organization. That is not illegal. That's not only not illegal, but it's something that the media does all the time.
Do you think differently at all about what you say online in the last couple weeks?
I guess, but more so because I worry, and this is something that has always been at the back of my mind, I worry about the potential repercussions. It's not that I advocate for anything that I think is like unconscionable or violent or anything like that, mm-hmm. but it's more so that things can always be weaponized and misconstrued. The utilization of metaphor, for example, or hyperbolic statements made amongst friends that can be reflected on years later in a very different light. These are things that happen all the time on the internet.
Is it because you are worried that you could physically be silenced and killed the way that Charlie Kirk was? Or is it because you don't want to have something misconstrued and somebody maybe act on those words in a way that you don't want them to?
Or? Yeah, I'm worried about the administration taking action. That's always been a fear. If I let that kind of fear cause any sort of like editorial setbacks, I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing. If I let fear dictate my commentary, if I let fear dictate my life, fear of like violent repercussions coming from random people who want to take matters in their own hands, then I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing. I worry that the administration might take unprecedented action that is otherwise illegal against constitutionally protected speech.
If we can't have conversations in this country, and if having those conversations has possible consequences from the administration or others, what happens?
We end up in an authoritarian nightmare where one of the last bastions of liberalism is eroded. And there is no way to go against the wishes of this administration, no matter how violent they may be.
That's Hassan Piker, one of the leading voices in leftist political commentary, speaking on the state of free speech following the assassination of Charlie Kirk. This is NPR News.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Dine Out for United Way of Bemidji is now through Friday, October 10th. Restaurants throughout the area will donate a portion of their sales to support the community. Find more details at unitedwaybemidji.org. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you're just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. Gotaska Community Action in Grand Rapids is collecting gently used kids' Halloween costumes now until October 15th. Costumes may be dropped at the former Murphy Elementary building from 9 to 4 weekdays. Happy Dancing Turtle is offering Family Nature Play Days, a chance for children ages 2 to 7 and their families to explore nature at the Hunt Utilities Resilient Living Campus in Pine River. Dates are Friday, October 10th from 10 to 11:30 a.m. and Tuesday, October 14th from 3:30 to 5 p.m. You can find more info at happydancingturtle.org. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE KBXE. Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local, and given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out.
and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
It comes from this station. And from Ooma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. And from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $70 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of over 700,000 animals. Learn more at subaru.com/pets. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And Mae Martinez in Los Angeles, California. More than 100 million followers, dollars, have flowed into campaigns over California's Proposition 50. The November ballot measure asked California voters to approve new congressional districts that favor Democrats. It's in response to Republican-led gerrymandering efforts in Texas and other states following demands from President Trump. From member station KQED, Guy Maserati has more on what's become an expensive fight on California's airwaves.
Governor Gavin Newsom has raised over $90 million in support of Proposition 50. Marva Diaz, publisher of the California Target Book, a nonpartisan election guide, says much of that money has come from the usual suspects of California Democratic fundraising.
So you see the Nurses Association, SEIU, lots of labor money, lots of high Democratic donors pitching in.
But there's also big money from outside of the state supporting Newsom's push to pick up 5 congressional seats for Democrats. Prop 50's top funders include a group working to elect Democrats to Congress and an organization run by mega donor George Soros. The Prop 50 campaign has also raised millions in small dollar donations from residents in all 50 states.
I think it speaks to how important this is to the Democratic Party.
Prop 50 would temporarily set aside a congressional map drawn by a citizens commission created by California voters. But Newsom has focused his campaign squarely on President Trump.
Wake up to what Donald Trump is doing.
The Yes on 50 campaign has ads criticizing Trump for cracking down on free speech and failing to lower costs.
On November 4th, you have the power to stand up to Trump.
One word not mentioned in those ads? Redistricting. While the Yes side is focusing on the national stakes, the campaign against Prop 50 is defending the work of the Independent Redistricting Commission
that spent thousands of hours meeting with California citizens to create fair election districts.
That shouldn't be a surprise. The No campaign's top funder is Republican donor Charles Munger Jr., who bankrolled the ballot measure to create the commission back in 2008.
Prop 50 destroys this good work.
Despite donations from National House Republicans and former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, the No side has raised less than half of what the Yes on 50 campaign has brought in. While Newsom is clearly the face of the Proposition 50 campaign, opponents are hoping for a boost from another familiar voice to Californians.
This is why it is important for you to vote no on Proposition 50.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, the state's former Republican governor, championed the creation of independent redistricting in the state.
Democracy. We got to protect it and we got to go and fight for it.
When he spoke out against Prop 50 in an event last month at the University of Southern California, the No campaign was there to film it and quickly turn it into an ad. Marva Diaz, again the publisher of the California Target Book, says Schwarzenegger can be an important voice in opposition, especially for swing voters.
Him coming out saying two wrongs don't make a right is really a powerful message.
But Diaz says Schwarzenegger has resisted taking a more active role against Proposition 50, perhaps feeling the campaign has become too partisan.
I don't think he wants to be associated with Trump.
Still, with voting underway, Californians should get used to seeing lots of Schwarzenegger and Newsom on their TV screens. For NPR News, I'm Guy Maserati in San Jose.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Well, I've got two brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled and Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Our lover was a climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high wear cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
Tariffs to help farmers harmed by tariffs.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Mercury. Mercury brings together banking, credit cards, invoicing, and more to help entrepreneurs manage their finances. Learn more at mercury.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. When President Trump slapped tariffs on Chinese goods earlier this year, China just stopped buying crops from the U.S. farmers, just shut those purchases down. That obviously hurt U.S. agriculture, and so the plan was for the government to help those farmers out with aid from the revenue raised by the tariffs. That plan has been delayed because of the government shutdown. But we have been to this rodeo before. Marketplace's Savannah Peters has more on how this all went down during the last trade war during President Trump's first term.
The first Trump administration's farm relief package paid out more than $20 billion, mostly to soybean and other commodity crop farmers. Some analyses found that amount more than covered their trade war losses.
The levels of funding were unprecedented at the time.
Joe Glauber is with the International Food Policy Research Institute and also served as chief economist in the USDA from 2008 to 2014. He says that short-term relief didn't make up for the trade relations that were lost, maybe permanently, while U.S. ag exporters were sidelined and other countries stepped in.
Brazil has increased production a lot since the 2018-2019 trade war. They are, at least for the time being, the major supplier of soybeans.
To China, the world's largest buyer. In September, Purdue University surveyed U.S. farmers on whether they expect a bailout similar to what they saw 6 years ago.
And 83% said likely or very likely.
Still, Michael Langemeyer, who runs Purdue's Ag Barometer Survey, says farmers' assessment of conditions in the agricultural economy and the potential impact of tariffs slipped.
What about the long-run market share? Are we going to be able to go back to where we were even a year or two ago after this is all said and done? You know, trade payments are great.
But Langemeyer says U.S. farmers would rather have a stable market for their crops. I'm Savannah Peters for Marketplace.
During the first Trump administration, the amount of aid paid to farmers to compensate them for their losses due to tariffs nearly wiped out all the revenue brought in by the China tariffs themselves. Gold just keeps climbing. It hit $4,000 an ounce today in Asian trading. This has been one of gold's strongest monthly performances and its biggest sustained rally since the 1970s. BBC's Nick Marsh has more.
Even allowing for inflation, this is the most valuable that gold has ever been. A delay in the release of key economic data in the United States due to the current government shutdown has likely contributed to this latest surge, but gold's been growing in value all year. 2025 has seen interest rate cuts, which make gold more attractive to investors, as well as Donald Trump's sweeping import tariffs, which have upended global trade.
That's Nick Marsh with the BBC. The price of gold is up 1.4%. It's at $4,060 an ounce. All right, let's do the numbers. The FTSE in London is up 0.7%. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are up about 0.2%. Dow futures up 81 points. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.11%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager. On personal and business devices from any location, Bitwarden is designed to secure sensitive information without the need to remember multiple passwords for every site, account, or application. Learn more at bitwarden.com.
Tariffs go up, tariffs go down. New tariffs pop up, old ones are in limbo. For U.S. businesses, it is all just a lot. So we are checking in now and again with businesses around the country to just see how they are doing. One of those businesses is the Eldon Street Tea Shop in Reston, Virginia. Rachel Rosner is the owner there. Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me on the show again, Sabri. I really appreciate it.
So last time we talked, you mentioned you were paying very high tariffs on tea coming in from China, but you do import tea from all over the world. But also you'd asked for some sort of exception to the tea tariffs. Are you still paying those same tariffs as you were in July?
Yes, except India went up to 50%. So it's even worse.
Right. So you're actually paying more.
Correct. Yes. And actually, we are halting all purchases from India currently for tea. We're halting them until, I guess, the Supreme Court hearing on tariffs on November 5th. And it's become kind of a cat and mouse game of can we buy things stateside, like our inclusions, like lavender and rose petals and things like that? Or is it cheaper for us to pay the tariff and bring it over?
As we talked about last time, there's not a whole lot of tea grown in the U.S. It would basically be impossible to replace the global supply of tea with U.S. tea. But let me still ask, has the domestic tea industry here changed at all in response to tariffs?
Yes, it has. It has gotten much more expensive. So any tea that's coming in through a middleman that sells it in the United States, it has gotten even more expensive.
In July, you mentioned that you had not yet started to raise prices for your customers. This is something that a lot of businesses have resisted doing. But at some point, it gets untenable. And I'm wondering, are you having to finally raise prices?
Yes, we are raising. We have raised prices on some of our teas. We will be 100% increased on our teas by the end of October. And coming into holiday season, getting different accessories that go along with tea is appearing to be impossible just because of the markup that I'm going to have to make.
1 year from now, where do you see yourself? Where do you see your business?
I think a lot of it lays on the decision of the Supreme Court on November 5th and what we're going to do with our business. I think we will probably consolidate what we have. Until the tariffs are lifted. And fortunately, our customers know that they are going to get delicious, good quality tea, but it's going to be a little bit more expensive.
Rachel Rosner, she's the owner of Eldon Street Tea Shop in Reston, Virginia. Good to have you on again.
Thank you so much.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. And KAXE is bringing you a brand new podcast, Love Tuesday Mornings with John Latimer, debuting Thursday, October 16th is KAXE Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. A podcast for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. Itasca Pride hosts The Occasion, an adult prom, Friday, October 10th. Tickets include dinner, dancing, and transportation. Find more info at itascapride.org. Native Defense presents the second annual Our Voices